very nice to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of things this weekend, but one of the great jokes of my life, daughter of mine, is that I'm like a in my life, this is how I ended up working in Albuquerque four times a year and as an observer and participant of Voice and No Vote on the region on board. And if you'd asked me 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I would have said not a chance. But it's been a real learning experience, and my term is coming to an end in May, so I'm glad to meet some more of you, even though that time firmly is winding down. So lots of you have ventured here before, maybe this is your first time. How many of you have, I'm going to get a sense of the abstinence in the room. So how many of you have 20 years of abstinence? Okay, and how many of you have 15 years? And that should be perfect. Okay, 10. Okay, that's there, good, thank you. How many of you have 9 years? 8. 7. 6. 5. 5 years, everybody, great, congratulations. 4. 3. Over here, okay. 2. 2 years of abstinence, right? 1 year of abstinence. How about a month? 10 months. 9 months. 8. 7 months. Back there, okay. 6 months. 5 months. 4 months. 90 days. 4 months. Okay, 90 days. How about 60 days? Okay, good. 30 days? Okay. And so how many of you have less than 30 days? Okay, good. Alright, good. How many of you came into the program and then stayed in the program, regardless of how long you've been in? Virginia, is that you? Okay. So how many of you have come back after leaving for a while? Few. Okay, good. This is my purpose to work in the vertical region office on July 1st, 1980. And God asked me to write the way it came, little Nick away. I need everything that everybody needs to know in about 90 days. And then Christmas that year, I was abstinent on Christmas Day, and I was abstinent on Boxing Day, and on the 27th, I knew that a bowl of potato chips and some brownies would make my life better when I'd be living with my in-laws. And so it just needs 2 days to be, you may have done this, I'm not sure, but within 2 days I was calming ice squares and putting them in the pocket of my own telescope and eating them in the bathroom without getting any ice in on my pocket, right? I said at the time I'm really grateful that I came in before there was a donut shop or a restaurant near the corner. And when I came in, they came in just probably $5. So I'm blessed there as well. The interesting thing for me in that first split was that I kept saying, when I get home and get back to my program, I'll be okay. And I didn't understand that I took my program with me. Right? I missed that piece somewhere along the line. Can you guys hear me? It sounds really echoey and weird up here. Yeah? Okay? All right.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir? Step back? How's that? Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, let's try that. I'm going to just move this over again. How's that? Is that better? Okay, we'll play with it until we get it right. Better?
Okay.
All right, so by way of some history, I'm the oldest of 7. In my understanding of the disease, both my parents were compulsive overeaters. When my dad retired, he changed over from food to booze. He was also a sex addict whose crime victims were children under the age of 2 and mostly the 7 of us. He continued abusing us until we were all either of menstruation age or teenage years, depending on how that went in our lives. And mine was a textbook poem of how not to grow up. And so when I look back on that today,
I want you to know that I'm really proud of the girl I was. I didn't learn to bath, you know, we didn't have running water. Bathing was a big deal Sunday and the tap because my parents bothered to do it. But when you're an incest survivor, you don't think about being clean because you feel so dirty anyways. And so I didn't learn to bath, I didn't learn to wash my hair, I didn't learn how to be friendly, I didn't learn how to get along in the world with other people. What I learned was how to run things and be in control, and I learned how to eat to numb out all the pain. And that was a pattern that lasted until I was 30. Now, I'm a bit of a control freak, as you probably guess, so I made sure before my weight got super high that I'd go on a diet and I'd lose it, and then I'd, you know, start over again, because we're good on diets until we reach that magic number, right? And then we open up the fridge and go to the corner bakery and away we go and get it. I got married at 18. I married my first baby. People told me it wouldn't last, and they were right, and you know, after 30 years of marriage, I suggested to him we might want to separate, and we did. And so I've been single for 10 years, and actually I quite like it. I may never get married again. Please, God. She would say that, she laughed, right? Humor, sense of humor that my God has sometimes turns the inside out. I have three children. I have a son that's 36. He has two kids. I have a daughter who's 34. She has one little girl. And I have a 32-year-old daughter who has two little kids whom I have never met because she chose when her dad and I split up to not speak to me again. And we've just had no contact for almost 10 years. And I wish I could tell you what I did wrong, but I don't know. So what I do know is she won't talk to me. She will catch my checks if I send her birthday presents, which I stopped doing some years ago. But she just has nothing to do with me and no good reason. She's never given me a reason for why she feels that way. And what I've learned is, you know, it says in the big book, wife or no wife, job or no job, right? Kid or no kid, I can abstain and keep going. What happened for me in 1980, at the end of the year of 6 months of abstinence and a slip, I hit the city limits. We were on our way home, and I thought to myself, well, okay, you're home and you're back to your program, so you better straighten up. And so I did what we all did when we were starting out again. I went on a diet, right? But I promised I was never going to tell anybody that I had that slip. And so I came back to the city, and I was absent that morning. We drove home about 3 hours from my in-laws' lived to our home. And I was absent, that was Monday. And I went to my home group on Wednesday, and I got up to talk about how wonderful Christmas had been. But I was going to not lie, just omit the truth, right? I was absent on Christmas, and I was absent in New Year's. And isn't that a miracle, right? Just forget those 3 days in between. And I got up to the front because we, at that time, used to sit theater style in that group, and I started talking about how wonderful it was to be absent on Christmas, and I started crying, and thanks be to God, ended up telling them the truth about how I had eaten those 3 days. And what I learned is that we are a very accepting, loving, tolerant group. Those women love me, in spite of having been this away, in spite of having trying to tell them over and over again what they needed to do, this is not the same. In spite of all the things that I had done to show them that I knew more than them, they were most gracious about loving me and accepting me in spite of this flaw. You see, I grew up with many character defects, but one really serious, fatal flaw. My dad believed that my mother was too stupid to live. And he took no pains to tell her that at every moment of every day. And if we did something that was childish or silly or immature, he'd say, you're as stupid as your blankety blank blank mother. Now, I don't have to tell you very many details like that. And you know that my greatest fear was to look stupid. Okay? Above all else, I must not look stupid. That makes me an information addict. It makes me a reader and a studier. It makes me a person who has to be informed about anything, everything. And if I'm not informed, I'll leave the conversation so I don't look stupid. I'm better now with that, but it's something I still struggle with, this idea of looking stupid. Because I truly have no idea in my head what stupid looks like, right? It's any time I do something dumb, right? Any time I'm human. I'm working on that. I keep working on that tape in my head that says I'm stupid. I'm doing stupid things. Anyway, I was in the program about 3 years, and I got abstinent again, stayed abstinent, life was good. And I remember thinking, well, if this is all there is to this OA stuff, yeah, I mastered it. Why should I stay? Right? Anybody ever think that? Yeah, I got it. Yeah, I got it. Hey, I'll leave now. And my husband had been a teetotaler for a number of years for a number of reasons, and he decided at Christmas Eve that he was going to have a glass of wine with Christmas dinner in 1982. And by the spring of 1983, he was a daily drinker. And I didn't realize how bad it was, because I'm sitting there thinking I'm a little Miss OA, and I know what I'm doing now, and I don't have all the answers, just most of them. Well, because I'm an information junkie, right? So if you need to know something, I'm going to look it up and tell you. And if I don't agree with what you think the answer is, I'll tell you that too. Just for your sake. If you don't want to go around looking stupid, I'm sure I'll be happy to straighten you up. So I noticed this drinking. There were some really weird things that happened. And one day he walked in. He'd been spending a lot of time in the garage, and he said, I said to him, what's wrong? You don't seem to be hanging around very much. And no, everything's fine. And, well, I know something seems wrong. And no. And I kept adding, because I'm a tenacious little pit bull at times. And finally he said to me, I've decided I don't love you anymore and I want out. And I went, what? Huh? You know, where did that come from? We hadn't had an argument. And he said, no, I've decided I don't love you anymore and I want out. And I did what any reasonable person would do in those circumstances. I cleaned my house so that when I committed suicide, my mother-in-law would know she'd been wrong all those years. If he lived in a pit, right? I didn't eat, so, you know. And in retrospect, isn't that a miracle? I didn't eat. Now, I did all the other things that we codependent people do. You know, I begged him to stay. I offered to let him live downstairs. He ran his own business, and when he said he expected me to keep doing the books, I said, sure, okay, if that's what makes you happy. And he had a massive personality change in a very short period of time. I was privileged to witness what happens with 7.5 years of abstinence in an alcoholic's life when he goes back using. And it's not pretty. And I don't think it's pretty for us either, by the way. I think we get pretty sick pretty quick. But anyway, so I did the one thing I knew to do, and that was go to Al-Anon. And I was there about, this insanity started in the spring, 1st of May-ish. And I went to Al-Anon probably a couple of weeks later, and the women in Al-Anon saved his life. Because truthfully, I'd have killed that bastard if he hadn't straightened up. You know, I had no capacity without food to deal with that kind of pain, with that kind of threat to my life, to my way of life, to my view of myself. I had worked for a few years after I finished high school, and a couple of years after we got married, but I'd been an actual mom. I had no education, I had no skills, and I was a mess, and I was terrified that he was going to leave me for some pretty young thing down the street. Now, the great irony is some 30 years later, he did just that, and all I can say is, have at it, honey. But at that time, that was a terrifying piece for me. And so, he never left, and I never made him go, even though he kept threatening and going to go look for a place. A sample of how crazy I got in that time, he'd go looking for an apartment or a house with no checkbook to put a deposit on it. And he'd come home, and that would make me crazy, right? Don't you understand? You can't rent a place without a check to put a deposit. What the hell's the matter with you? You're just doing this to upset me. And, right? You can hear the conversation. And so, even though I didn't want him to go, it was so important that he do it right, you know, that I'm going to help him. The end result for me was that I phoned a friend in Al-Anon. My sponsor was away. And I told her what was going on. And he was going to move with my truck and then come back and get his truck. And I knew that wasn't good. It was like leaving twice, right? And I got three kids and it should be good. And the first woman I talked to, she was kind of black belt Al-Anon. And she said, oh, yeah, let him go. I'd drive the green truck up there and help him move. And I went, oh, she doesn't understand. I hung up the phone and I'm crying. And now I'm sure none of you have done this, but I went through the phone list and found the gentlest, kindest, most grandmotherly woman I could find on that phone list. And I phoned her and told her my sad tale of woe, and she said, oh, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't move him. I said, you wouldn't? What would you do? She said, I'd pack the basket first, then I'd ship him off. So my children and I actually helped their dad pack so he could leave. And the interesting thing was, before he got out the door, he broke down in tears and said, will you let me stay if I go to AA? Now, we talk about coming to the rooms and the importance of osmosis, but my experience watching him is a little bit different. He went to meetings three or four times a week for about 2 years and then dwindled down to once a week from there on. If you don't work these steps, and if you don't do what you need to do, at some point in time, putting your buns in the chair isn't enough. And so we went into a period of living in dry drunk. I'm abstinent, I'm clean, I'm still crazy, but I'm abstinent and clean, and he's a dry drunk. And it was just a zoo at our house. And so what ended up happening was that a couple of years later, he got caught out with another woman at lunch, blah, blah, blah. Whereas nothing happened, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. By that time, I'd given up looking. And so he put himself into treatment. And again, as crazy as I was, now this is 5 years, 6 years in, 6 years of abstinence, as crazy as I was, all I could think of, you know, he'd phone every night, and he was like a different guy. He was talking about how he felt and so on. And all I could think of was that he was going to leave me for somebody else. Right? Now that I finally straightened him up, right, got him to where I wanted him to be, he was going to leave me and I would be left high and dry yet again. Now, when I say that today, that sounds really ludicrous, but it's honestly how I felt. And I was so terrified and so wound up with hurt and fear and pain that I need to tell you that I went to lots of meetings. I was the chair of the intergroup at that time, and that really kept me sane, because once a month I had to be present and accounted for and thinking about something other than him. Right? It was really one of the best things that ever happened to me. Then one night while he was still in treatment, I was laying in bed and I was praying and I was crying and I was afraid. Of course, I'm not praying that I will be done. I'm praying, bring him home. I want him to be the way I want him to be. Let this be the answer to all my prayers. And I had the most incredible experience happen in the midst of that terror and that fear and that crying and all that stuff. My room filled with warmth. And it filled with, the only thing I can describe it is love. And I knew in a moment that I was going to be okay. I didn't know whether the marriage was going to survive. I didn't know whether he was going to be okay, but I would be okay. I knew that. For that day, I knew that. Now, I got to tell you, that kind of spiritual experience was pretty amazing, and it's good for about 24 hours. After that, you're on your own again. Goodbye. Right? Because we can't live, I can't live in that intensity of feeling. And so what ended up happening was he came home, he was a different man, he stayed there. They had to go home 6 weeks before they went back. And by the end of 6 weeks, he was back being the same old guy I'd married. Right? We went down together as a couple for communication week. And it was great, and it was wonderful. Oh my God, he's the man I always wanted. And we came home and he forgot. And he went back to going to one meeting a week, and he never shared his meetings. He'd always say, my name's Wayne, I'm an alcoholic and I'll pass. He never, to my knowledge, worked with Beth. He had a sponsor whom he never phoned. And he just got drier and drier and drier. As you can imagine what it's like to be on a diet. And truthfully, he did that for 15 years. Our willpower is quite amazing. And what I know as I watched him is that I kept coming to meetings, and I kept doing therapy, and I kept reading books, and I kept going to retreats, and doing service and praying and working the steps. And a miracle happened because I changed. And it wasn't quick and it wasn't easy. And I still have days when I revert back to tight. But I work really hard at being well, emotionally well, psychologically well, spiritually well, physically well, and also. At some point in time, when you start drinking in those first few years, I knew if I was going to support my kids, I had to get an education. And so he was drinking, and I prayed, and God said, go to school. And so I did, and I got a degree in business administration. And it was a great degree. I was doing lots of volunteer work at that time. I tried to get this thing to stand up, and it just won't. It was quite amazing to me that I became a pretty good student. I discovered I was a good student. Now, many of us have had that experience. We get out of the step and our head clears and we can think clearly and we become quite intelligent. What's interesting for me is I was accelerated 3 times in school. I did grades 3 and 4 in 1 year and 6, 7, and 8 in 2. That's the one to stay on.
Let's drop it right here.
And yet, even with that, I was so terrified of looking stupid, right, that I never understood. That I thought I fooled them when I was in school. I thought I had pulled the wool over somebody's eyes. And I didn't understand that I had been gifted with a fine mind. It just never crossed my mind. It wasn't until my body in here and within here a few years. And I talked about maybe I could go to university. And my sponsor said, well, yeah, why not? You know, and I said, well, I don't know if I could do it. You know, and I had all those excuses. And she said, if you're not the food, you can do it. I'll promise you that. You're smart enough. And it was the first time anybody said to me, you're smart enough. Because coming from that place, there's nothing worse than looking stupid. It was really important. Anyways, I did go to university, and then I spent the next 10 years in school. I did a bachelor of, we call it Bachelor of Commerce, it's a business degree, 4-year business admin. And then I went working, and I had the experience of then tripling my income in 5 years. I made really good money for a while there. Had staff across the country, reported to the general manager, so I was pretty top shit for a little while. And they laid me off. In that process, I got bored. I did a bachelor's of psychology. And then after the raising off, I did a master's in counseling psych. And I'm not a psychologist, but I do a lot of work as a psychotherapist, working with primarily women alcoholics who are looking for a therapist to understand these things. And I have a privilege to share that journey with all of those women. I also work right now as a manager for the Calgary Health Region, and it's interesting that I'm the only Canadian-born staff member in my department. All the rest of them were born internationally, and I've never been beyond the United States for travel. So it's kind of interesting, again, that sense of humor that God has brought to my life. I think that it's important that I tell you that, you know, January 1st, 2007, I celebrated that in 26 years of abstinence. And it's not always been perfect. What I learned for me was that I'm a sugar addict, and a little bit is not enough. If I'm going to have a little bit, I want a lot. So I just don't have a little bit. I know, now you may know this, I know this, a bowl this big, you know, Louise's hands are about 18 inches apart, it's really 2 cups of that. Right? We all know that, right? And so I know that I have a brain, well, it's really smart, it's not real good at facial stuff, so I need to weigh and measure my food most of the time. This disease made me different all the time, so I won't take weight scales in a restaurant. I respect people who do, but that's not my program. I've been a vegetarian in this program. I've done low carb. I've done moderate meals. I've tried all kinds of different things. As my body has aged, I've needed to adjust and adapt. Not too long ago, a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with celiac, and so I have a gluten intolerance, which means no wheat, no rye, no barley, and usually I don't eat oatmeal either because it's very often processed in the same mill, so the gluten molecule sticks. And I've got to tell you, I haven't eaten much bread for years because it goes right on my hips, right? And something happened when that doctor said you have celiac disease. And I kind of stamped my teeth like a two-year-old, and I said, well, if I can't have wheat, I'm going to have rice, damn it. And so I started eating rice bread like there was no tomorrow. You know, appropriate meals, a sandwich at lunch, a piece at dinner, toast for breakfast. But those little suckers are like 200 calories a pop, and they go right straight to your head. And yeah, 10 pounds later, I thought, what the heck am I doing here, you know? So my weight has gone up, my weight has gone down. I had one period of time about 5 years ago where I was back. I was out four times a week. I had not moved up the wazoo. So I got tired of it. Do you guys have a problem with boredom? You do something so long and you get sick of it, right? That's my truth. And then I took a glycogen, so I kind of dwindled off, and I actually set some money aside to hire a trainer. Do you know why I need a trainer? Can you get? If I make an appointment with a trainer, I'll be there. If I make an appointment with myself, I probably won't. I'll find a good excuse. I'll be going here 10 times, but I'll be fine about going again. What I've learned is I have to put things into place to help me overcome my inertia, whatever that inertia is around. Sometimes it's around changing my food plan. Sometimes it's around changing my home group. Anybody else in this room have to change their home group ever? And they kind of wave low and don't have to raise your hand. I don't want to do that. You know, it's comfortable. I feel safe. I know those people. I may not like them. I may be really frustrated at the end of the meeting, but I don't want to change. So it's important for me to take some action to overcome that inertia. I learned at my kind of like two or three jobs ago that it's way easier for me to complain about what's wrong than to accept it for what it is and either live with it or get out. That's really hard for me because I figure if I talk about things enough, they'll get better. Right? They don't. Right? You just don't. I had to learn that my dad's passed away now, but I had to learn that my mother is never going to be the mother that I want. She's not going to be June Cleaver or the Walton mom. She's not going to be that woman who sees me as her daughter. My relationship with my mother is such that I'm a caregiver and she's a child, and it has been since I was 7 or 8. Because her favorite last words to me were, you're smart, you do it. Right? So I got punished for being smart, and I got punished if I wasn't smart. So you can see how very quickly I learned to live in a no-win situation. I could never get it right enough. And so I kept banging my head against this brick wall of the relationship with my mom, trying to get her to love me the way I wanted to be loved. And one day a very wise woman in this program said to me, when are you going to get that your mother is who your mother is and she doesn't love you the way you want to? Oh, that was a real eye-opener, and I kind of went puzzling for a while. And then when I thought about it, that was true. But you see, the problem with accepting that truth was that I had to look at my relationship with my mother. Because if I'm not trying to gain her favor and trying to get her to notice me or taking care of her so she's happy, there is no relationship. There's nothing. And so I step back in that relationship. She's done nothing wrong. She's not a bad person. But I have to accept she is who she is, and that has very little meaning in my life. I think many of us, and I'll put me at the head of the list, suffer from what I call the Hallmark card syndrome. You know? Mother's Day card? Mom, for everything you ever did, for loving me and always being there. Dad, on Father's Day, thanks for being a wonderful, caring, strong role model. Yeah? We're so busy trying to live that dream of what we think could be or should be or might be that we forget to live in what is. This program taught me to live in reality. I'm a sugar addict. I'm a food addict. I'm kind of a lazy bones at heart. You know, I struggle with inertia. I have a hard time, so much better in the last couple of years with that. And the rest of you have that tape in your head that says you're not doing it good enough, fast enough, smart enough, clean enough, whatever, right? Yeah, I have that going. I've got to tell you, I learned one of the things that I do with clients that come to me for therapy is I say, okay, well, that's what's not working, what's working. And my youngest daughter had invited me to their wedding. The wedding was held at my son-in-law's parents' home. And so I wouldn't have gone without an invitation. I did get one. And then she called me on Wednesday night and invited me to come out Friday for the rehearsal party. And this was never anything I had thought could ever happen with my kids. I spent a lot of years working to be a good mother, to parenting courses. You know, did lots of stuff around being a good parent. And I had talked to her for about 3 years at that point in time. So I was thrilled to get an invitation to the wedding, and I was really nervous. And I got out to this rehearsal party at a farmhouse north of the city. And she introduced me to her future father-in-law. He looked at his watch and he said, nice of you to finally show up when all the work is done. And I kind of blushed. And it turned out that my daughter had invited my sisters and my mother to come out in the morning to help get things organized and decorated and hadn't invited me. But he thought I had chosen not to come. So I went, oh, interesting. And so then it was a potluck. She hadn't told me that everybody else brought food out to me. It was a bring whatever soft drink you're drinking kind of a night, and she hadn't told me, so I hadn't brought anything. There were a couple of other things that were supposed to happen that everybody else did, and I didn't because I didn't know. And with my history, the natural thing is to feel stupid, right? Really natural. What the heck's the matter with you? And so, this was in 1998, so I've been in program, I've been out in 17 years. I felt her dad. I hadn't seen much of him. We've been separated for, we've been separated for a couple of years. I hadn't seen him. Had a chance to visit. We had a very amicable divorce. And, so that was good, you know. But I left there, and I was crying so hard I couldn't see the drive. I was just brokenhearted that a daughter wanted to treat me like this. I mean, I come from this incestuous, violent family, and I still talk to my parents, right? I couldn't see how I could be treated that way. Anyways, I drove away and I'm sobbing and I'm all over the road and I pulled over and I parked and I said, okay, so what would you tell your client? Well, that's all that went wrong, so what went right? Well, I had a good visit with her dad. I had a nice visit with my son. He's been working building roads and I hadn't seen him for a couple of months. I didn't eat anything. That's pretty amazing. I conducted myself like a lady. You've got to know that what I wanted to do was give her a backhand and tell her to smart enough. How dare you make me look stupid in front of these people? I didn't do that. I acted with grace. And I didn't go to them and say, you know, she never told me that I was supposed to do that stuff. She didn't invite me to get her. I'm sorry. I didn't do any of that stuff. Kept my mouth shut. Did what I wanted to do, had a 2-hour conversation with the minister about matters spiritual, and left. And all of a sudden, it hit me, it had been a wonderful night. Because I was going to go home and go to bed with a clear conscience. I have absolutely no control over what that kid does. None. But it's my choice how I react to it. Now, I never understood, and in truth I still don't, people all the time say, hey, panic is like, don't get it, sorry. I wasn't feeling very grateful that night sitting in my car crying about what had happened between her and I. But I heard a speaker at a retreat talk one time about what he called the book of positive aspects. And what he explained and what works for me is that gratitude is an emotion, it comes from inside. But we can intellectually make a choice when things are ugly to look at what's right. Because there's never a day that there aren't some right things. Now, I should be happy that I'm healthy, right? I'm really healthy. I should be really grateful for that. And some days I am, but some days I take it for granted. Right? But I can always, in my book of positive aspects, write down, I'm healthy. Because that's a logical, rational choice. Some days I feel gratitude around that, some days it's just a logical choice to recognize. So I did that, sitting in that car, I made that list. These are the things that went right. When I got home, after that rehearsal party, I knew the next day was going to be just fine. And it was. She talked to me all day. I went to leave at about 11, leave the wedding, and I wished them, happy honeymoon, good life, lots of joy. And my son-in-law said, "Well, you're coming back tomorrow for gift opening, aren't you?" And I said, "No, sorry, I'm not. I have other plans, and I didn't know about it, so I can't change them." And he said, "Well, that's okay. We didn't expect you the day after." I said, "Well, I guess I told you, didn't I?" And I did, so I was there, and I left. Alright, what's that? No anger, no tears, no shame, no food. I don't know about you guys, that's a miracle in my life, right? I drove home, I had a girlfriend, we went to the local donut shop, had a coffee, talked to her about my day. Shared with her how it felt to go through this process. This was the first of my kids to get married. It was my baby, too. She was mommy's girl. Now, what's interesting to me from a kind of a psychological point of view is that her husband's parents are, as I understand it, both alcoholics, and he probably is, too. And over the course of their marriage, she stopped talking to my sister, she stopped talking to my mother, she's now stopped talking to her sister, too. And they've moved, and they've moved, and they've moved, and now she's in a small town about 2 hours north of the city where she knows no one. If you've ever been in an abusive situation, you know that she's been set up to do that, to suffer that, right? His father has been arrested for being his mother. Okay? And what can I do about it? Not a darn thing but pray. And stay clean. Because over time what happened was I learned that this was part of the dynamic of their marriage and I was a victim of it. And nothing to do with me. She's got excuses to pin on me. It has nothing to do with me. So the good news is, I can be over. How many of you have had something come up? And it's really ugly, and you eat, and then you find out the next day or the next week you misunderstood, you mislabeled, you misdecided. I used to do that. You know, I jump to conclusions. I have to do it all the time. My mother, bless her heart, really worried about me being down here so much. You know, I come to Albuquerque 4 times a year, and we do probably 3 board meetings, and region one in somewhere in the U.S. a year, and my mother's really nervous about that. She watches all those CSI shows, and she knows who all carry guns, right? She knows. If I say the wrong thing, I'm going to get blasted. That's truly her, my mother said, bless her heart. But that's her perception, right? And she worries about my safety because her perception is her reality. What I didn't know until I got abstinent and stayed abstinent for a while is that my perception of the world is skewed. Right? And I didn't know that. So I put too much importance on this, not enough importance on that, I screwed that up. Everything was about me, and it was about, because I had this kind of wavy glass through which I saw the world, I couldn't get a straight lead on what was going on. When I look at the situation with my daughter and son-in-law, I will be single. I moved out of the family home in May of 98. So it'll be 10 years this year, this May. We just had enough. She's had the first baby, she told me she was pregnant, and I was invited to come to the hospital on Saturday to see him. And when I got there, she said, please come late Saturday afternoon. And it turned out she was expecting to be released Saturday morning, but the doctor hadn't come. Right? So I happened to see the baby there. She says had another baby that I've never seen. I was not told she was expecting. I've not been given her pictures. I have nothing to do with those kids. And that's her choice. What I had to learn is her behavior is not a reflection of how I mothered her. It's not. It's a reflection of her perception of the world. And I don't have to agree with it. And I sure as heck don't like it. But what did I get when I eat over it? What's the benefit? There isn't any. Is my eating a cake today going to make her talk to me tomorrow? You know, if I insist that Alicia stop on the way back to see her at the airport on Sunday and buy me, I don't know, whatever the heck it is on the way between here and there. God knows where I dropped the drink here and there. And I make a pick of myself. Is that going to change anything? Well, lots of stuff going on in my life right now, lots of stuff going on at work, lots of stuff. It's been just a really interesting year for me. What changes if I eat? Nothing, except I'm crazy and I lose the skills to cope. And yet somehow I always thought, I'm unhappy, I'm sad, I'm afraid, I'm lonely, I'm frustrated, I'll leave. Somehow that's going to make it better. I think what I did for myself is, when I did that, I gave myself permission in the morning to focus on the scales and how I looked in the mirror. Dumb, dumb, stupid, stupid, what's the matter with you? Rather than dealing with the problem. My marriage was dead. My kid doesn't talk to me. I have a job I don't like. Right? We can deal with the food and the weight. We know how to do that. We know how to beat ourselves up about how much we weigh or how fat we are or how we look in the mirror. We know how to berate ourselves for the fact that we made some poor choices. We all know how to do that. Anybody here not know how to do that? If you need a lesson, come see me. I'll sure show you. We do it all the time. And it gives us permission to focus on that problem rather than the real problem. I come to believe, and this is just my opinion, and you know, I'm probably going to get this weekend is my opinion, but I come to believe that we have three different addictions that we label compulsive overeating. One is addiction to a substance. I'm a sugar addict in the same way that alcoholics are addicted to alcohol. You know, it doesn't matter if it's molasses or corn syrup or whatever, it's still sugar and it still cooks me and it starts the phenomenon of craving. Some of us are addicted to feeling full. I've got to eat till we're stuck. And if that hole, there's the least bit of room in our tummy, we've got to eat again. Right? And sometimes when we're addicted to feeling full, we get up through the night to eat. Because we've got to fill that hole. We need to feel full. And some of us are addicted, I think, to the activities that go with eating. What I would say is similar to a gambling addiction. Don't raise your hand, but just nod wisely. How many of you buy and read cookbooks? Right? How many of you drive to food markets an hour, 2 hours away to get the perfect fresh vegetable or the best fresh fruit? How many of you spend hours planning menus and meandering through the grocery store? So I'm abstinent. What happened for me is I got abstinent and I started baking bread. I can play with it. I may not be eating it yet, but I can play with it. An activity around the food. So I encourage you, if that makes sense to you, to give some thought to what kind of addict are you. Now, I know there are bulimics in the room and there are anorexics in the room, and that's a whole other story. I'm just talking about the addictions around compulsive overeating. Give some thought to you. Do you have more than one? Because I think sometimes we try to treat one of them, you know, I'm going to take a food plan and live with it, and we forget that if I'm addicted to the activity around food, I used to do gourmet cooking. In a program, in the cupboard, Ties for wearing. You know, I'm sure you've had one of my flaring pastry ties. I did it all the time. I could play with it if I didn't need it. And so give some thought to what are some of the signs of your relationship with food, particularly if you're struggling with abstinence. The other thing I encourage newcomers to do, newcomers who come to me to sponsor them, is to take a look at what you're addicted to. Now, I got to tell you, I listened to Dr. Oz when he's on Oprah, and I bought his book, The Aging Body, and I pay attention to nutrition. I work for the Health Region for God's sake, but of course I pay attention to those things. I sometimes take supplements if I remember. I don't remember very often because I'm good at starting, but I'm not good at long term. And so what I know, though, is that I need to be aware of me. I think it's kind of funny that all the experts out there right now are talking about lifestyle changes, right? You know, it's not a diet, it's a lifestyle change. We've been singing that song for 45 years. And we call it abstinence. I think what happens for some people, and probably nobody in here, but certainly some of the people I've sponsored, is that we get on this train that says it's got to be 100 diet-proof perfect. So it's got to be 1,200 calories a day. Now, you may not measure calories, but you know how much to the black green bean you can eat, right? And you measure it and weigh it, it's perfect. And if you're out by a little bit, oh, we might ask you, well, I can't go for that in the shop. Okay. So I encourage you to think about, what are you addicted to? In Alcoholics Anonymous, I was at an AA meeting last night when my client had a birthday and invited me to celebrate. She said, I promised I would push a piece of cake on you. And I said, good, I'll come. And so I went to a meeting. You know, the guy there didn't talk about during his talk was coffee. He talked about abstaining from alcohol. He talked about sobriety and recovery. He talked about the fact it took him 10 years to quit smoking after he walked into AA. He talked about the fact that it took him a while to find the right work that suited him as a sober person, as a recovering person. I think sometimes that we get so hooked into we got to do it perfect right now. You know, for me it was that fear of looking stupid. So I've got to start exercising, I've got to drink my milk, I've got to take my vitamins, I've got to weigh and measure, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. And if I don't do it all, I haven't done anything. And so I would like to give you permission to try and find out and define your addictions. And start there. Turn them over to God. And then one day at a time, build. I think, you know, we talk about, in service, we talk about the inverted triangle. And that's what I think about abstinence. I mean, my baseline abstinence, I don't eat sugar or anything that's got sugar in it. I eat 3 meals a day. Sometimes I have a metabolic, sometimes I don't, depending on what food plan I'm using at that time. But that's my baseline. And then I layer it on top. You know, if I'm a vegetarian, there's no meat, there's, you know, I make changes. I've discovered as I age what I can eat and what I can't eat has changed. I came into the room at 30, I had 3 kids, I'm 57, I got a dog, you know? Like, my body's needs are not the same, and I need to adjust for them. I'm trying to figure out what that adjustment looks like right now. I was privileged to hear our founder, Rosanna, and Hulda G from Israel, she's a student in my book, speak at World Service 1 year on the aging body. And Rosanna said she gained 5 pounds the year before, eating exactly to her food plan. And she went to her doctor, and the doctor said, oh, you can only do that. And so she came back. And lost the 5 pounds, and she's not willing to carry that weight. Hulda said the same thing had happened to her. She went to the doctor, he said the same thing. She said, I'm 67, what do I care about 5 pounds? They both had long-term abstinence. Hulda was not willing to live her life in deprivation. Now, I'm not saying either way is right, but these are two women that had years and years and years of abstinence. And they hadn't agreed on what this was about our bodies as we age. So I encourage you to think about it and figure out what's your truth. What are you addicted to? And what do you need to do to let go of that addiction so that you can live in peace? I had a miracle happen for me this year. Last year I went to some career counseling. I was doing a job that I had really loved. But that's the point, it was just, I didn't want to go, and didn't want to be there, didn't want to do work, felt like I could do it with my eyes closed and two times tied behind my back. I was running groups for families, counseling families of adults with mental illness. I'm basically teaching them Al-Anon and Susie Bessel. And so it felt really tiresome, so I went to a therapist, a career counselor, and he and I got talking. And what he helped me see was that I had a cycle around work. You may have the same cycle, or you may not. I get a new job, and given what you know of me, what do you think I have to do when I get a new job? Learn all about it, right? Yeah, that learning curve just went straight up. And in my head, if I wasn't learning quick enough, what was I saying? Stupid, stupid, stupid. What's the matter with you? Why don't you pay attention when you're going to get it? What the hell's the matter with you? Why are you so slow? And then as soon as I learned everything, guess what happened? Oh, I don't want to be here anymore than before. And so what it helped me see was I was creating an employment cycle. Oh, she took about 2 years. And as soon as I mastered a job, which meant I was no longer saying ugly things in my head to myself, as soon as I mastered a job, I'd go and find a new one so I could start that cycle again. What's wrong? You're stupid. When are you going to get it? What do you learn? And so I thought, okay, I don't want to be in this job anymore. I know I've mastered it. I know now learning, I accept education. Learning is a real integral part of who I am. But I started this new job. I have 50-some staff. They provide interpretation, translation, services to the health region. We've got a fairly large immigrant population in Calgary, and they provide services, but to be clear about that, I don't speak Canada's second official language. So I'm the only Canadian-born member of the staff. Okay, so we're clear about where I fit in that. I got hired because I'm good at organizing things. I want to tell you that with abstinence, the things I learned in the program, my recovery, I can count on these two fingers the number of times I've said in my head, Louisa, being stupid, when are you going to get this? And an interesting thing happened. When I wasn't beating myself up, guess who got it a whole lot quicker? This is amazing. 3 months in, I was getting compliments about how much I'd learned and how I stepped into the role and thought I'd be there forever. It's just amazing to me, right? And I didn't go down that path of what's wrong, why aren't you getting it, you should be smarter. It truly was a miracle for me. Now, maybe you don't play those tapes in your head. I think most of us do. That there's something wrong with us. It may not be your intelligence, it may be something else in your head. But most of us have a constantly playing tape of criticism that says we're not good enough, we're not smart enough, we're not thin enough, we're not pretty enough, we're not something enough. And I would like you to give some thought to what does your tape say? And if you're struggling with abstinence, how does that tape impact your ability to be clean over the long haul? You've got 30 days or 5 days or 20 minutes. What does that tape tell you about yourself and how does that relate to your ability to be abstinent or not? Because I think it makes a huge difference for us. And I think we play that tape and we set ourselves up to fail over and over and over again. You know, the big book in Step 7 talks about turning our character defects over to God and asking, humbly asking Him to remove these defects of character.
And it's because of that tape in our heads that we can't take charge of that, I think. We need to just let it go and let it be. A couple of things I wanted to share with you. Abstinence isn't always easy. Sometimes it's really hard. I had a period a few years ago where I gained about 35 pounds. And I was weighing and measuring my food and working with a nutritionist, and she said I was eating about 900 calories a day. And I just kept going up. I went to the doctor, thyroid was fine, everything was okay, and I just kept going up. And one day I was reading, Prevention Magazine or some silly thing like that, nothing to do with program health kind of related thing. And it talked about the impact of HRT on weight for women. And I had been taking estrogen, I've been wearing an estrogen patch for, coincidentally, 4 years. And I had asked my doctor over and over, could this stuff be causing the weight gain? No, that's not a chance. And so I made the decision to go off of it. I did very slowly wean myself off of it. And I ended up, 40 pounds just fell off of it. Put some of them back on when I did the two-year-old stamping my feet about the rice bread. But that's what my vocal folks do, because I don't do that anymore. The reason I tell you that story is that I got to tell you, there were many nights I leaned my head against the mirror in my bedroom and I sobbed about how bad I was. What's the matter with me? I don't understand. You know, my nutritionist kept saying, you need to eat almost twice as much as you're eating a week. You're never going to lose weight at this calorie intake. And every time I tried to increase what I ate, you know what happened, right? Up goes another size, right? My body just wouldn't tolerate it. And when all was said and done, I was given such an incredible miracle in that time. Because not once in those 4 years did I say, the heck with it, I'm going to eat. You all taught me that eating doesn't solve a problem. It just adds to it. Now, I wish I could tell you that I was some miracle worker, some saint in that process. I went to lots of meetings. I made lots of phone calls. I did service. It's really hard to fuss about your weight, but if it is a group meeting, they don't really care. I made phone calls. I read literature. I sponsored. I had a sponsor. I went to online meetings. I did all kinds of things. Because I knew the moment I said, to hell with it, I'm fat, I might as well eat, I was going to be off to the races. When I came into the room to Bob Reader's Anonymous, I was getting a pound a day. And I was eating nonstop. And I wasn't huge, but I knew I was going to be 300 pounds for Christmas. That was in April. I knew I'd be 300 pounds for Christmas. I had no doubt. And I know today that if I get back into eating that way, I'll be that bigger, bigger again by Christmas. It's not hard. It's really not hard to do. Living in sobriety is hard. It's easier. It is hard. Very dear friend of mine, one of my early sponsors. I should tell you that, Calgary's not very old. I thought, 27 years, I think in July of 1980, so 26 and a half years. And when I came in, the old timer had 2 years. Right? We all looked at her as the guru. Oh my gosh, she's got 2 years. Isn't that wonderful? And all the way along in my recovery, she was 2 years ahead of me. She maintained a 140, 150 pound weight loss for about 25 years in these terms. And one day she decided, for 101 reasons, that a chocolate bar wouldn't hurt. And she gained it all back. And she came back for a while, and was absent for about a year, and then crawled back into the food. And now won't even come to me. She won't take calls from other members. I phoned her one day, and I said to her, tell me, just, I don't even want to talk to you. as a member of Oasis. Tell me what happened. So why do we walk that path? And she said, I have a really huge issue in my life that I can't and won't deal with it. And if you've got stuff, you won't deal with your only choice is to be. So, I encourage you to take a look at your lives. We do it in a fourth step. We're going to talk about that over the weekend. We do it in the course of our relationship. I don't think I'm the only person in this room that is in an empty, lonely marriage. Yeah. I moved out, I live all by myself. I've never had a room of my own, and now I've got a house of my own. Pretty cool. And I've never been lonely in that house the way I was in that marriage. Yeah. By the way, after I moved out, he, after 15 years of not drinking, took the bottle again. He's doing about a 14-ounce a day. Hooked up with a young woman the same age as our children, got married, and they have two lovely kids. They're both preschoolers. And he's 63. And all I can say is, God bless. He can have him. Her dad was an alcoholic, and her mother put up with it. We live these patterns, and we are the generation, we are the ones who are trying to change eons of history that came before us. And so I thank you all for coming, and I encourage you to think about, what are you addicted to? Substance, activity, or feeling full? I encourage you to think about the tapes that play in your head. What are the words that you hear over and over again? And I encourage you to understand that there isn't a single thing you can do, that there isn't a single thing that can come up in your life that you can make better by eating. You'll be heavier, you'll be thinner. I promise you, you'll be older if you get abstinent and stay abstinent. I guarantee you that. But I guarantee you, you will go through life with a clarity that is unimaginable. And I promise you, it's worth it.